This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and later Iraq, many expatriates made plans to return home. Doctors, lawyers, architects, and engineers who'd been forced to leave by the Soviet invasion or Saddam's repression would help their countries to rebuild. It hasn't worked out that way. There is instead a new wave of exiles, and professionals and businessmen have both the means and the motive to leave. In Iraq, it's gotten so bad that human rights groups believe there's a concerted effort underway to target professionals and academics, and that was before the mass kidnapping 2 weeks ago at the Ministry of Higher Education in Baghdad. Iraq's educated class is fleeing the country, going to Jordan or to Syria, and many of those who do stay are too afraid even to leave their homes. So many have fled the country that Iraq is in danger of losing the core of skilled people it needs most, just as it tries to build a newly independent society. Much the same is happening, though on a smaller scale, in Afghanistan. But this brain drain isn't merely affecting Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran, Syria, Lebanon, many countries in the Middle East are fighting to hold on to a proud professional and intellectual tradition in the face of war, despotism, and poverty. This hour, we'll look at the effects of the brain drain in the Middle East. We'll talk to those who fled to find out what might happen as a consequence. And later in the program, our political junkie joins us to administer his weekly dosage of political news. If you have questions about the aftermath of the midterms or about 2008, you can send us email now. Our address is talk@npr.org. But first, brain drain. If you're an expat from Iran or Afghanistan, call us. Or if you have questions about how to stop the departing tide of skilled professionals or what might happen to these countries as a result, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And that email address again is talk@npr.org. Keith Wattenpaz, an associate professor of modern Islam at the University of California at Davis and author of Being Modern in the Middle East, Revolution, Nationalism, Colonialism, and the Arab Middle Class. He joins us today from the UC Davis studios on campus, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we know that things have gotten very bad in Iraq, Professor Wattenpaz. What role do you think the professional class there will be able to play in Iraq's reconstruction now?
Well, I noted recently at the gathering of the Middle East Studies Association, you know, within the next 6 months to a year, it's highly unlikely that that professional class will have a relevant role in rebuilding Iraq if current trends continue.
Mm-hmm. Yet you've also written that you fear the academic situation in Iraq within a year is going to be almost insignificant.
Right. It's there, to my mind. Things are worse there than they have been since the U.S. invasion 2003, and they'd already sort of started on from a very tough place after the sanctions and living for so many years under Saddam Hussein. Now with the violence and so on, it's reached a point where everyone who can leave is leaving, and that the thing which allows people to leave, the education, the acumen, the professional training and so on, is that thing, that very thing which is most needed for rebuilding Iraq.
What happened in Iraq's universities? And I know reading some of the things that you've written, it started with a sort of informal debathification process.
Right. Well, immediately after the war, there was what I call the informal debathification to distinguish it from the formal debathification, which was a coalition provisional authority order. And in that case, those professors, those administrators who were most closely identified with the party and had used their positions to abuse students and professors were informally debathified, which often meant being taken out and shot or being forced to leave the campuses. And that's changed over time, in which more of a political dynamic and a sectarian dynamic has infected the campuses and has rendered the campuses almost an irrelevant feature of Iraqi society, which is really unfortunate, because for Iraq, higher education was one of the last intersectarian spaces. And it was hoped that from the campuses, a different kind of Iraq, or at least a vision of a different kind of Iraq, could emerge. And I'm very skeptical that will be the case any longer.
Mm-hmm. So that even if they came back, some of these professors who've left the country would find themselves in an untenable situation now?
Right. Well, one of the working hypotheses we have is that when people leave, they very rarely go home.
As you look at the situation, human rights groups, as you know, have come to the conclusion that there seems to be a concerted campaign to assassinate or drive away the elite class, if you will. Is that something that you believe to be true, or is that something that, well, it just seems so bad that you could come to that conclusion?
Well, there certainly are interest groups in Iraq who would like to see the more sectarian, the more secular, the more Western-looking leave the country. And that's part of the equation. The other part is just that it's about power, and the universities and the campuses represent centers of power that various groups want to control. So whether or not there's a plan in place, the fact remains that Iraq's academics, its professors, its lawyers, its professional classes, because of who they are and because of their training and because of the past, have all felt really the brunt of targeted assassinations and so on. Many of them, though, are being killed for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is, you know, as we saw this last month, almost 3,900 people were killed in Iraq. Many of those were just random acts of violence.
We're talking about the brain drain specifically from Iraq and from Afghanistan. If you've left there, if you know somebody who has, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Marcy. Marcy calling us from Baltimore.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
This is a discussion that is of particular interest and importance to me. I have a very dear friend who's a physician, just left the U.S. after bringing injured children to the United States, just left, went back to Baghdad. She had a home in the Green Zone. Her home was no longer available to her through other circumstances, and she's now living in the Red Zone. I am desperately fearful of her safety, trying to convince her to leave. She feels very strongly that she must stay because of this brain drain. And 2 days ago, her uncle was kidnapped. Her family are immobilized. They're living in their homes. They can't conduct any of their daily activities. And I have tremendous respect for her for wanting to stay there and sending a message to her colleagues about how important it is to stay there. And yet I wonder at what price, at what cost. She's doing that.
Keith Wattenpaugh, that must be a familiar dilemma.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, one of the real dilemmas is those Iraqi intellectuals, academics, doctors, and so on that were seen to be too close to the Americans were often the ones first targeted. And that was a very difficult fact for the early American occupational forces to try and deal with. And now we're seeing, you know, other things happening. People who know English well enough to translate and so on are working to try to create some kind of collaborative action between the West and Iraq are the ones most easily targeted. So my heart goes out to this physician, and I would hope that more people could do that. But I think that for many of these individuals who leave, they're thinking about themselves second, but their families first. And many times they're getting themselves and their families out. And this is something that's been going on in the Arab Middle East really since the 1890s, where the considerations of the society and so on take second place to the considerations of the family. And getting out for your family and protecting your family is very important. And so I've never ever wanted to point fingers at people and saying, why didn't you stay? Why didn't you stay? Because the decision to leave is one that is so hard and so heart-wrenching that when people leave, it's the most difficult thing they've ever done in their lives.
Marcy, we wish your friend the best of luck.
Thank you. Please say a prayer for her and for her family.
Okay, thanks very much. The climate for professors in Iraq has gotten so bad that even those who have fled the country are afraid to speak out. Joining us now is an Iraqi professor of humanities who was forced to leave the country. We've agreed not to identify him, but he's working at a university outside of Iraq with help from the Scholars at Risk Network and the Institute of International Education Scholar Rescue Fund. He joined us from there today. Professor, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to have me.
You taught at a major university in Iraq. Why did you decide to leave?
Well, you see, the situation in Iraq is getting very dire and dangerous for academics, for the liberals, for the open-minded people, those who promote free speech. And they are either harassed, threatened, or killed. And most of them decided to leave the country because of the situation. And now the campuses in Iraq are overruled and controlled by the militia, religious militia, namely the Mahdi Army and the Supreme Council of Islamic Republic. They are after the academics, the faculty, in order to impose their own values. And I've learned that some classes have been canceled and they rock the syllabi and they are trying to separate the girls from the boys. And the warlords in Iraq, actually, they are eyeing the universities because the professors are holding different views. They are more open to the West. And their agenda, I mean, the warlords, is to model the Iraq now. They are working hard to model Iraq on the Iranian example. And that's why they are forcing the women faculty, the girls in the school to wear a scarf, long scarf on Iranian model. And they changed some of the classes and they are working hard. It's a very sad story to see Iraqi campuses overruled by a forest of turbans.
Yes,
I believe they are hiding behind religion. Any faith, any religion is tolerance, coexistence, peace, love. But those who preach violence now have nothing to do with religion. They are hiding, actually.
The militias you referred to were both Shia militias. We just have a few seconds before we have to go to break. You spoke of a lot of abstractions in terms of intellectual freedom and that. Was there an incident that convinced you it's time to go?
Yes, you see, I was harassed. I was threatened myself in different occasions, and I was advised to leave the country. And I decided to go to Jordan immediately at midnight, and I had my breakfast at the borders. But directly, it was narrow escape. I was bombed, you see, and there was an attempt to kill me. And after that, I managed to wriggle myself out, so there was no place for me. I love my country. I traveled a lot. I lived in England, but my eye is on my country, and I have this motto, East, West, Home, Best, and I have a vocation. My responsibility is to rebuild the country and to embark on a huge project of modernizing the syllabi, open the country. And I know the bulk
Professor.
Of the Iraqi academia is secular, liberal.
We're going to have to take a short break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to the United Nations, nearly 2 million people have fled Iraq for neighboring countries, mainly Syria and Jordan, since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Many of them are intellectuals, doctors, and lawyers who are badly needed to rebuild Iraq. Today we're talking about the brain drain, not just in that country, but in Afghanistan as well. Our guests are Professor Keith Wattenpah. He's an associate professor of modern Islam at UC Davis and the author of Being Modern in the Middle East. Also with us is an Iraqi scholar who fled the country because of threats, and we've agreed not to identify him by name today. Of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. If you're an expat who left your home country in that part of the world, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. And, Professor, I wanted to follow up. You were talking about the threats that drove you out of the country just before we had to cut away from the break. We've been talking a lot about very practical professions, architects and engineers and doctors. In the humanities, there is something important that will be lost if that is lost in Iraq as well.
Yes, sure. You see, now any professor, any open-minded faculty is a sitting duck for the insurgents, for the militia. They don't want such people. They want to impose their own values. And these people, you see, have no place now. And most of the positions have been taken by those Iraqi graduates who hold MA now. So the first generation, the second, and even the third are dispersed. They left the country under one reason or other, and they are in diaspora. And this has highly affected the standard of education in Iraq and the campuses now. We lack, actually, during the war and after the war, rack and ruin. The libraries, the labs were destroyed. So now the wave of violence and killing and harassment is detrimental, quite damaging the scientific and academic standard in the country. So the universities are now undergoing a spate of violence that will rock. And I think that the academia in Iraq now is tottering on the brink of the abyss unless there is a strong, heavy message to the Iraqi government. It's the responsibility of the Iraqi government to secure and offer the professors safe haven and protect their life and create a situation that they can carry on their mission, their teaching. So far, nothing happened from that, and I do believe that the government is part of the militia, and those uniforms are not stolen from the police. They are the police uniform. They use them at daylight for government purposes, government work, but in the evening they use it for different other militia activities. I'm very sorry to say that, but I see now Iraq is controlled by the militia, by the warlords, and I expect the American administration has to use a heavy-handed policy and a strong message to the Iraqi government and tell them straight, we kick Saddam, not you. Do you want democracy? This is your country.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Farouk. Farouk joining us from San Diego.
Thank you very much, Neil. Just to follow up on what the professor was making, the comment which he was making with regard to the exit of large number of educated people. In my immediate family, I have a sister who was the head of one of the exceptional students for girls. She loved the country. Her husband is a professor at Baghdad University. They left. I have two nephews who are engineers. They left to Dubai. A niece, a doctor, and her husband, a doctor, went to Jordan. I mean, I can go on and on and on.
And do any of those family members, including yourself, Farouk, do they plan to go back when things get better?
Well, the thing is, you know, I've been living here for 44 years. I'm a U.S. citizen. But the majority of the people who have left from my immediate family and extended family, they have a desire to go back. The problem is, as we have been talking about, the issue of security, the issue of indifference, the issue of sectarian violence, the issue of individuals who really don't want educated people to be in the country. They want to push back the country 50 years or 100 years. That's really the dilemma. That's the tragedy. I have a lot of nieces and nephews in my extended family who are Baghdad University, the technical university, who are not attending classes out of fear, out of kidnapping, for ransom, out of the whole situation is an absolute disaster. And
Keith Wattenpaugh, this makes your description of the Iraqi higher education system, that it still has a year, that makes it sound optimistic.
Well, it is. But one thing I need to emphasize, and I think we all should consider this, is that brain drain can be slowed and it can be reversed altogether. And we have good examples of that. It's not an inexorable process. You know, if we look at India, India has a reverse brain drain situation where educated Indians are returning. There's, to some extent, the Arabian Gulf has seen this, and also Algeria, after the problems of the Algerian war against the Islamists had come to a conclusion. And we even saw brief glimmers of the reversal of the brain drain in post-Oslo Palestine in the late 90s, when hostilities between Israelis and Palestinians were reduced tremendously, that money and capital and professors and professionals were moving back. And we also saw this in Lebanon. But we also saw how fragile it was and has been in Lebanon and in
Palestine.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it evaporates almost as quickly as it was established.
Professor, very quickly, before we let you go, that fragility, as you look at the situation in your country, you have to make a decision relatively soon. Are you going back?
Yes, you see, everything depends on the situation in Iraq. We are deeply rooted in our country. I'm missing my library, my dog, my country, my home. I'm missing a lot of things, but this is a temporary location for me, and I should extend my sincere thanks to Scholar Rescue Fund and to Duke University and to the other institute in the United States who offer me help to continue my work. But you see, I'm praying for peace to prevail. My students need me, and I need my university, and this is my mission, and this is my vocation, and I should adhere to it. It's my pleasure to go back as soon as the situation changes, and I think our country is in desperate need of the liberal minds whenever they are allowed.
Well, Professor, we wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. for having me.
That's an Iraqi scholar who was forced to leave the country due to the worsening violence and threats, and we appreciate his taking the time to speak with us. We've decided not to identify him for obvious reasons. As mentioned, Iraq is hardly the only country being drained of its intellectual resources. Afghanistan faces a host of post-Taliban problems as well. Joining us now is Obaid Younossi, a senior analyst at the RAND Corporation. He's been kind enough to be with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you were of the generation that left Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion in late 1979.
I was going to say that this is the story that we're hearing about Iraq. Afghanistan has been facing that story for the past 26 years. The first wave of the brain drain that occurred in Afghanistan was in the late 1970s and early 1980s. That was the wave of the Afghan professionals that left. And then the second wave was with the civil war and the fall of Kabul and the socialist government, that people that had socialist leanings but still educated core of the elite of Afghanistan that left the country in the onset of the invasion of Taliban.
And, of course, post-Taliban in recent days, things have not been exactly great.
Yeah, actually, after the fall of Taliban, there was some brain gain. People from the West, as well as, of course, a large number of people that emigrated in the neighboring countries in Pakistan, as well as Iran, they did go back to Afghanistan. But unfortunately,
did you think about going back?
I did think about the idea at one point, but I've been here for so long that I've put in roots and I have my own family and the kids, which makes it very difficult for us to sort of uproot everything that you've built and go back. But, I mean, people like me certainly can contribute, and they have contributed to the rebuilding that's going on right now.
As you look at, I know you've been back to Afghanistan, but the situation now, that brain gain that did occur after the fall of the Taliban, that seems to have been reversed.
Yes, as you mentioned, I went back about this time of the year last year, and one of the things that was disheartening was to see, again, long lines in front of the passport office, as well as the long lines standing, trying to get visas to other countries. And most of them, I mean, people between the age of maybe 19 to mid-40s, the people that actually are needed to rebuild the country, people with skills. I mean, we've talked a lot about the professionals, but the people that are actually needed are really the bricklayers, the carpenters, the people that start small businesses, the entrepreneurs. Those are the people that actually both of these countries need, especially Afghanistan. And when the onset of the uptick in violence and the new phenomenon in Afghanistan with respect to suicide bombings that has occurred and civilians being targeted, that has created an environment that people are rethinking. I mean, a lot of people are thinking about leaving the country again.
You did see a big influx of money and investment in especially Kabul, but this is a city that, well, you could understand why, if you had some options, you might want to consider going elsewhere.
Absolutely. And a lot of people are asking about the investment and what happened to the investment. And there was the first few years, there was this euphoria that, well, there was this huge change in the country. And then as the elections were completed and as people, the donor countries, agreed to provide funds to the rebuilding of the country, and a lot of people that participated in these activities didn't see much change in their livelihood, their normal lives. And then there's still no electricity in Kabul, and there's only a few hours per week, no clean water, no basic public good type of services that people could sort of count on. It's very difficult to get around Kabul. The streets are a mess. And even going from one side of the city to the other side of the city, it requires hours to. I mean, it's very difficult for the university students and professors to get from their homes in one side of the city to get to Kabul University. So the environment and the security, lack of security, has created an extreme challenge for people.
Let's see if we get a caller on the line, and this is Ali. Ali's with us from San Francisco.
Yes, hi. I just want to say thanks for your program.
Sure.
I left Iran, not Iraq or Afghanistan, 21 years ago, and I was a student in the university, and your previous guest that was talking about the takeover by the ideological forces that I saw the exact same thing in Iran, and there were several incidents, you know, that you could clearly see. There's they separated the men and women, and they canceled classes, and they were forcing their own agenda. It's totally believable to me that that's happening in Iraq today. So my sympathy to all the open-minded people that are running away from this. This is a big threat. And the other thing, a small correction comment I wanted to give to your guest from UC Davis. It's not the Arabian Gulf, it's the Persian Gulf.
You get into a long argument about that.
A friendly disagreement.
Okay, Ali. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
We're talking about the brain drain in the Middle East, specifically Iraq and Afghanistan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you, Obaid Younossi, as you look ahead to the future of Afghanistan, which I guess part of you considers your country, part of you considers this your country too, but does it look as bleak as you've heard things painted for Baghdad?
Not really. I mean, I think there's a lot that has been accomplished in Afghanistan. I mean, we when I was there, with respect to access to information, the number of newspapers that are there, the discussions that happen in private television. So there's a lot of things that are substantially different from even the time that I left the country. So there has been a lot of changes, mm-hmm. but this insecurity and the lack of security is a cause for concern.
And getting worse in Afghanistan, obviously.
Absolutely.
Long beyond getting worse, and hard to imagine how it could get worse in Iraq. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Ibrahim. Ibrahim calling us from Denver.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning where you are, good afternoon where we are.
Or rather, good afternoon for you. Well, I have listened to the speakers before. I'm originally from Iraq. I left Iraq after a long imprisonment during Saddam's period. While it is critical to discuss the problems that we have in the Middle East in general due to lack of security, there is one fundamental point which is absent so far, has been absent from the discussion, that U.S. policy to deliberately target a particular country and allow people to get out of that country through the exceptional visas. I mean, Iranian case is an example. Where thousands of visas are given to the intellectuals to come and become taxi drivers in Los Angeles and other places, deliberately to weaken the intellectual structure within that particular country. That point has to be brought into the discussion, and so far it has been absent.
Well, let me ask Keith Wattenpaw, do you think that that's a fair allegation?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, that most visa policy is defined primarily by humanitarian reasons and so on. And as I've said before, the act of leaving is not something, it's not a decision taken lightly by any of the people involved. But I think this brings up a very interesting irony, which is that the brain drain is deleterious to the societies, Iran, to Iraq, to Afghanistan. But if we just look around us, American society and Western society has been tremendously enriched by the people leaving these countries. I mean, one of the great examples we have out here in the Central Valley is William Saroyan, whose father was brain drained from Ottoman Armenia before the turn of the last century. So I really can't agree that the United States has a policy to undermine the intellectual elites of these countries. In fact, I think that we tend to err in the other direction. But ultimately, I think we as a society benefit tremendously from these immigrants. I think our long-term hopes for the region do include creating situations on the ground where people want to stay and can have a relevant role in the development and democratization of their societies.
And just let me ask you briefly, we just have a few seconds left before we have to go, but is not the exodus from Iraq benefiting Syria and Jordan, and similarly with Afghanistan? You think Pakistan and Iran would be the beneficiaries?
Absolutely. In Syria, Syria embarked upon a large-scale development of private universities just in the last decade, and they found a ready source of professors in the Iraqis who are very well trained and very good academics to work in those schools. And the population of Jordan has gone up by approximately 750,000 people, many of whom were in the educated elite or middle class who brought with them expertise and money and capital. So these countries around them are benefiting to some extent from this out-migration, but I think they're also more concerned about regional stability issues as well.
Keith Wattenpaugh, thanks very much for being with us today. We thank you for your time. Keith Wattenpaugh is an associate professor at the University of California at Davis and author of Being Modern in the Middle East, Revolution, Nationalism, Colonialism, and the Arab Middle Class. And we'd also like to thank Obaid Younossi, who was here with us in Studio 3A. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Obaid Younossi, a senior analyst with the RAND Corporation, with us here in Studio 3A.